This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Since the turn of this century, India has been the second fastest growing economy in the world.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is set for an election win. He's been in power for 10 years, and in that time, India has experienced an economic transformation, and Modi has been welcomed on the world stage.
Millions have lifted themselves out of poverty into a new life of possibilities.
But it's his Hindu ultra-nationalism and his use of anti-Muslim rhetoric that underpins his popularity.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been accused of making Islamophobic comments during an election rally, triggering widespread anger from Muslims and members of the opposition.
So who is Narendra Modi? What secrets are in his past, like the wife he walked away from, and his links to the world's largest far-right organisation? And why is he so popular, despite being so hard to pin down?
It's been hard trying to get people to talk to me openly about him. They're worried there will be consequences.
For her podcast series, Looking for Modi, the South Asia Bureau Chief for Australia's ABC News, Avani Diaz, explored every aspect of his life and career. And she tells us how her investigation into Modi's attempts to silence his critics has shut her out of India.
I'm going to be honest, as a journalist in India, I'm pretty nervous about getting into this.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Bernice Harrison. Today, who is Narendra Modi? Avani Diaz, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, we've invited you on In the News to talk about Narendra Modi, the popular and successful Prime Minister of India. He's 73, vital, charismatic, and he is, in many ways, the embodiment of modern India. But there's a dark side to him. He's built his political career on a philosophy of Hindu nationalism, often at the expense of India's large Muslim minority and other smaller minorities. He's been linked to outbreaks of sectarian violence, and his hostility to a free, questioning press has grown over his 10 years in power. Avani, you are the South Asia Bureau Chief for Australia's ABC News. And until recently, you were based in India, in New Delhi. But you had to leave India. Why?
Yeah, it was a strange experience. I mean, I started in India about 2.5 years ago, and I knew when I entered the country that there were criticisms of the Narendra Modi government, his handling of democracy in what is supposed to be the world's largest democracy. I knew that there were concerns around how the press was treated, but I didn't really expect to be in a position where I'm now talking to you from Australia while the Indian election, one of the biggest stories of the year, is playing out over there. And about a month ago is when things really escalated. I mean, from the very beginning, you know, there's constant pressure. As a journalist in India, there are constant threats, and there's definitely a chilling effect amongst journalists. But in the last month, things really escalated for me when I got a call from a ministry official, someone from India's equivalent of the foreign ministry, who told me that my reporting had, quote, crossed a line and that my visa extension would not be renewed. Now, every year we need to, as journalists, foreign journalists working in India, get a one-year extension. It's a pretty standard process, just a bureaucratic process that we go through. So I thought that mine would come through as it usually does, but I was told that that would not be the case. Now, the day before that, a story I had done on Sikh separatism, so this movement to form the state of Punjab in the north of India into a independent nation for Sikhs, which is a movement that has gained traction in countries like Australia, the US, the UK, and so on. I was doing a story investigating Canada's allegations that the Indian government is orchestrating hits on Sikh separatists.
The Narendra Modi government is being accused of assassinating a Sikh separatist on foreign soil. India says those claims are absurd.
It was a major story that broke last year, and we were looking into that on the ground in Punjab. Now, a story that I had done on that was blocked by the Indian government on YouTube, and it was taken down off social media sites.
It's clear that we're being really monitored and that there's concern about the story that we're doing.
And that is what preceded that call and me being told that I wouldn't get that visa extension.
And of course, massively frustrating for you to be out of India when the elections are going on. Now, in your podcast, it's terrific. I urge all our listeners to listen to it. It's called Looking for Modi. It's for ABC News. You explore his personality and his rise to power and the controversies that have followed him, but they haven't hindered him in his life. Throughout it all, his popularity seems to be undimmed.
Na Telangana Kutumba Sabhyulandariki Namaskalo.
What is it about him that Indian voters love so much?
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing, and I've been investigating it for the last year or so, speaking to people who are close to Narendra Modi, going to his hometown, finding out more about his life and through many people that have been in his life. And what I've found, especially speaking to ordinary Indians, is that people really love Narendra Modi. There is a huge popularity on the ground, and that's because Narendra Modi has told this story about his life as an ordinary person, someone who can relate to other Indians, which he compares to the previous leaders in India, mainly the Congress Party, which is the main opposition, which he describes as dynasty politics, educated, rich, English-speaking people who aren't like the ordinary day-to-day Indians. And that's a part of his story that has just really resonated with voters and something that people really relate to. And a big part of Modi's leadership over the last decade has been welfare policies, saying, I relate to you as someone who grew up in tough circumstances, I'm going to give you a house through the government or a toilet or whatever other form of basic welfare that these people need. And that has made people feel really empowered. And that's one element of Narendra Modi's leadership that's made him really popular going into what is expected to be a third term for him after this election. And the other element is his sort of appeal to the Hindu majority, this idea that Hindus in India, which make up the majority of the country, have been hard done by especially the Muslim empire, which came previous centuries, but also other religions and sort of othering them in order to make the Hindu population feel safe.
And Mr. Modi said, if the opposition Congress is voted back into power, it would distribute citizens' wealth among what he called infiltrators.
And there's been a lot of criticism around Narendra Modi's politics in that sense. So those are two really major elements which have really appealed to people. But then in the podcast, there are other elements to his life that I found so fascinating and crazy. I mean, he has this wife that he was estranged from when he was young. He was put into an arranged marriage with this woman from a village nearby, and he left her when he was a teenager to go walk around the Himalayas. So in the podcast, we go looking for her because now she's just living a normal life. She's not a first lady. She's never out and about with Narendra Modi. And for some reason, when that came out in 2014, it didn't damage his reputation at all. And it just shows how strong that narrative around Narendra Modi is.
Actually, there's a great scene in the podcast where you almost got to talk to her on the phone, but it doesn't quite work out. I mean, what sort of life does she lead now?
It's so interesting. I mean, you know, this woman who they were set up in very traditional circumstances in Gujarat, and it was, you know, the step-by-step process that a lot of people in 1960s and 70s India would have been going through. And I spoke to Narendra Modi's childhood friends who said, you know, all of us were getting married off at that age. And Modi decided to leave and wanted to forge his own path, obviously ultimately going into politics. And I found out that in India, it's actually quite lauded and celebrated to be a single person, someone who says that they dedicate everything almost in a monk-like fashion to their job and to leading the country, that their family is Indian people. And that's certainly the narrative that Modi has built around his prime ministership. But going to her village, I mean, we saw the circumstances she was living in. It is so ordinary. It's an ordinary Indian place in the west of the country, in Gujarat. The village, it's not poor by any means, but it's firmly average. And this woman, you know, people talk about her. We met people who had met her. They said she helps out and volunteers at the local hospital. She looks like any other woman. People are quite shocked to learn that she's actually married to the prime minister, who is obviously living in totally different circumstances. I've seen his bungalows in New Delhi, and, you know, it's a very grand place to live. So seeing that comparison between the two, and I don't think many people would realize that he has this secret wife that Narendra Modi really never talks about at all.
So you mentioned there his early life, but one early influence was his membership of something called the RSS. What is the RSS and what influence did it have on him?
So it's this organization which now has 6 million members, and it's described by many researchers as the largest far-right organization in the world. It very explicitly on its website says that India is a Hindu-dominant country, that Hindus deserve the first stature when it comes to India. And that is in contrast with India's secular constitution. The constitution specifically says that people of all religions are welcome and equal in India and should not be discriminated against. And India is a huge country. I mean, it's got several hundred million Muslim people, one of the largest Muslim populations in the world, and many other religions. People follow those religions in India. So the RSS ideology is in contrast to that is in the constitution. And we got rare access into one of these meetings of the RSS, which functions, again, according to researchers, very much like a paramilitary organization. Actually, some have described it to the IRA, but others are saying, well, it's not as extreme in the fact that it doesn't have weapons at this stage or anything like that, but it does train its members in things like military drills, combat, and so on.
So this shaka is happening basically on a grass patch on the side of the road, and there's maybe like 15, 20 people here, all men, and they're playing a whole lot of physical games, and then they're chanting a lot of slogans about Hindu nationalism.
And what we heard from the RSS is that it's actually just a day-to-day charity organization that helps people on the ground while trying to spread this ideology in a peaceful manner. So it denies those allegations about being a paramilitary organization. But it is really fascinating that this is where Narendra Modi started his political thinking. He was an 8-year-old that was recruited into this organization. Again, researchers say that's very similar to how a lot of these sort of right-wing organizations operate around the world. They recruit kids, bring them in through games and sort of these club sort of Boy Scout kind of meetings, and then sort of slowly indoctrinate them through their various political ideologies. And that's when Modi started as an 8-year-old in his village. He started going to some of these meetings. I met some of his fellow members who went with him when they were kids as well, and they're still part of the RSS. Now, Narendra Modi worked his way up through the organization over many decades. He ended up becoming one of their chief organizers. And then the RSS created a political arm, which is called the BJP. And although they are separate entities, the roots of the BJP started from the RSS. Some members of the BJP no longer agree with RSS ideologies. Others very much do. And Modi then moved into the party and was actively an organizer in the party, and of course worked his way up to prime minister of the country. And now the BJP has enormous power in India, in national parliament and in state parliament. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that those are the roots of Narendra Modi.
Another aspect that's quite surprising to me, maybe, is squaring his membership with the RSS with what happened to him just directly after he left his wife. He became a devotee of Swami Vekananda, a Hindu monk who died in 1902. I mean, this is an entire fascinating story in your podcast about the young Modi. He's free of his wife, takes to the road, and it seems as if he nearly becomes a monk, but then turns his back on that and goes back to politics. But the philosophy of Vivekananda is milder to the sort that Modi would have been involved with in the RSS. Do you think that experience shaped his politics?
Yeah, and it's interesting that he actually says that he trekked around the Himalayas and went across India, and he went to some of the ashrams, so sort of the centers that were built by people who were inspired by the Swami Vivekananda. He says that he went to some of the head monks and said, look, I want to join your order. I want to follow you. I'm a dedicated person that loves Swami Vivekananda. And they said, oh, no, this isn't for you. And then he says that the third time he went to one of these ashrams, he was told by the monk, your actual job is your life's path, which is social work and serving society in a different way, not through the monkhood. And he says that's what really set him onto politics. And again, this is a part of his story that, according to researchers, no one can really verify. I mean, there aren't records that show Modi went to any of these ashrams. It's something that only he has spoken about. No one else can corroborate what happened. But he has built this into his narrative because, A, it shows that he is, again, a monk-like person, someone who's the sort of savior of India. And that's something he specifically says in his speeches constantly, that he's, you know, received word from God to do certain things politically. But it has also, as you say, softened that hardline background which he's had. He has this ability to straddle both worlds. On one end, he can appeal to that Hindu right-wing majority, which is a big part of his base, his political base. He's really got that on board. But having the Swami Vivekananda, who is a really influential and very popular figure in India, someone that he says he's devoted his life to, someone he still talks about in his political career, that is a more moderate form of Hindu religion that he can really tap into and use that to say, look, I also appeal to the moderate type. So in many ways, Narendra Modi is a genius of a politician. I mean, the way that he has marketed himself and the way that he's told his story to people and managed to appeal to so many different parts of India is really something that a lot of politicians around the world can learn from, because it is really impressive the way that he's been able to do that.
So he's working his way up through the BJP party. It's relatively small and it's relatively obscure at the time, but it found success with a campaign around the idea that secularism in India had become biased against the Hindu majority. And what that led to was a mob destroying a Muslim mosque in 1992. That was a watershed moment. Thousands of people died in the subsequent riots.
For as the dust settles on the demolition at Ayodhya, it is apparent that the BJP has effected the greatest political polarization since independence. Equally importantly, the communal frenzy which followed the events of December the 6th has been so seared on the Indian conscience that perhaps India has changed forever.
What impact did that have on Modi and the BJP?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, that was a hugely divisive part of India's history, 1992, and a lot of people saw that as a real turning point for the country when it came to these religious clashes that we have continued to see in different ways in India. But, you know, earlier this year, I was there in that town, Ayodhya, where that new Hindu temple has been built in the place of that mosque for several decades since 92. So what, nearly more than 30 years. There's been this campaign to build that new temple, that Hindu temple. There have been court cases, there have been major inquiries, huge disputes in the public sphere about what should happen on that site. And finally, in 2024, Narendra Modi in January consecrated part of that Hindu temple, and he's made it a part of his prime ministership to really advocate for the opening of that Hindu temple, which many see as a real symbol for his treatment of minorities in the country. I mean, it's physically replacing what was once a mosque that stood in its place. And when I was there, On one hand, there was huge celebrations on the streets. People were very jovial. There was saffron-coloured robes when people were walking around on the streets. I mean, people were so excited. People were watching it across India. I mean, Narendra Modi managed to make so many Indians a part of that temple and that opening. But then when you turn the corner and spoke to the Muslim people who were in the sort of back streets living there, they felt left out. They felt worried about even walking out on the streets and what could eventuate and so on. But one key thing that Narendra Modi made clear in his speech was that he marked this as a new turning point for India, one where violence was over. He never actually specified the violence or the riots which had occurred after that temple opening, but he said that this was a new chapter for India. So it was really interesting and, again, really smart the way Narendra Modi spoke about it, because he tried to make it all-encompassing, and it was effectively his campaign launch for this year's election.
Can we talk about another riot? And that was in 2002. Modi, at the time, he was chief minister of the Gujarat region, which has a population of 60 million. That's just for context for us. The Gujarat riots, this was a situation that is being regarded as the darkest chapter in his career. What happened?
Yeah, and it's a really controversial one as well. I mean, there's a lot of division again over what happened in those riots. What we do know is that there were several people who died, mostly Muslim people, and those riots were triggered actually after a trainload of religious pilgrims had returned from that town, Ayodhya, which we were just talking about. They were there sort of in the fight for that temple, and when they came back, there was a train fire, and there's been a lot of inquiries into who did that train fire. Some people said it was by Muslims. Others said that it was not, that it was just an accident. But what happened afterwards, Narendra Modi's government endorsed the taking out of those bodies of those Hindu pilgrims who died on that train fire. And we speak to one of the family members of someone who died on that train. Those bodies were put in the middle of a town in Gujarat for many to see.
And this sparked off anguish and outrage and communal bitter feeling, leading to an attack on the Muslims.
That decision and other decisions triggered riots between Muslims and Hindus in that time. And that's a part of Narendra Modi's story that has caused him a lot of grief. I mean, after those riots, so at the time he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, he was banned from countries like the US, Europe, and the UK as well for a period of time. And he was really ostracized from the political and business communities. But he did manage to sort of bury that part of his story and try to move forward in an economic sense and sort of focus on that part of Gujarat and developing that. And he still managed to win future elections in Gujarat in very, very strong circumstances. So he did manage to put that aside. But even just in last year, the BBC released a documentary which scrutinized his role in those riots, and they were raided and that documentary was blocked, and that was a big controversy. So this is a part of his story that still does come up. But politically, I mean, he's welcome back in the US, in the UK. He just recently had a state dinner with Joe Biden. He's back on the political scene, obviously, as one of the most powerful leaders in the world.
And as you say, it didn't hurt him politically at home. He was elected chief minister in 2012. And then in 2014, he became prime minister of India. Was that because he was perceived as a good leader of Gujarat? Or was it more to do with his appeal to Hindu nationalism?
It was a combination. I mean, on one hand, he was seen as someone who brought a lot of economic progress to Gujarat. Now, some economists debate whether that was purely him or whether Gujarat's always had a lot of effective economic policy. But a lot of people saw the development that came in Gujarat under Narendra Modi's leadership there. And they thought, look, this could happen across the country. He also ran on this platform in 2014 for his first run for Prime Minister, saying again that he was different to the Congress, the main opposition party, which we spoke about earlier, one which had been plagued by corruption scandals. And he said, look, my aim and promise to you is that I won't be a corrupt leader, that I'm different to those leaders. And again, he really hammed home that idea of being the ordinary man, different to the political elite, which really resonated with a lot of ordinary Indians. Although there have been other previous prime ministers who've had ordinary upbringings, Narendra Modi has really had a poor upbringing. And that's something that's really admired by a lot of Indian people. And yes, those Hindu nationalist policies also resonated with people. So, you know, it's really nuanced, the kind of popularity that Narendra Modi has been able to garner. It's not just one thing that's brought him to get this level of popularity. I mean, some polls say that he's the most popular leader in the world. It's several different things that have made him appeal to different parts of the Indian public.
This is happening first time that that party, my party, BJP, is coming to power. This is a landmark. The people, the entire population of India, if all of you go one step ahead, then the whole country will go ahead more than a billion steps. This is people's power.
Can we talk about his popularity that's rooted in India's economic success? It's real. You make it clear in your podcast that people have really benefited. People's lives are better than their parents, for example. But there's a downside, and that is the huge and growing economic inequality, the gap between rich and poor. Is that a liability for him now during the election?
Well, it's an interesting question because on one hand, as you say, a lot of people that I spoke to before I left India on the ground were saying we are in a better position than we were 10 years ago. Our kids are going to be in a better position than we were growing up. And that's something that people really admire and that Modi's taken credit for, wrongly or rightly. There are some people who criticize him for that and say that it's a much broader government change that's allowed this to happen. But there are a lot of people who do feel empowered by those policies. But the thing that you also hear from even his most staunch supporters, especially young Indians, and it's worth noting that India is the youngest country in the world, so it has such a huge young voting population. Those young people are telling me, well, we need jobs. We don't have jobs. There aren't enough jobs going around. And, you know, Narendra Modi talks constantly about improving India's place in the world, which obviously he's done. India is so recognized now as a geopolitical player. Western countries are pivoting away from China and towards India. And he talks about the economic developments. And it is true. It is the world's fastest growing economy now, which is very admirable. But what economists say is that without jobs for people, which is the way that China managed to increase its economic growth, India will not be able to achieve those huge, huge strides that it wants to make and become one of those top three economic players in the world. So there is a lot of work to do if Narendra Modi gets into power, which he's very likely to achieve. And that real focus that people want is jobs and security once they, you know, may have a small house over their head, they may have a toilet in their village, but without a job, they don't have longevity. And that's the real concern for people on the ground.
Coming up, what is Modi's election promise to India's nearly 1 billion voters?
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
All right, voting has begun in the world's largest political contest, the world's largest democracy, with millions heading to polls in India's six-week election today. The vote is being viewed as a referendum on Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Now, the sheer scale of the election is mind-boggling. There are almost a billion registered voters in India. There are 15 million electoral staff, and they travel across deserts in northern India, glaciers in the Himalayas, jungles, oceans, to make sure everyone can vote. And all the polls say Modi will win. Are the elections free and fair?
Well, it depends who you talk to. I mean, on one hand, as you say, it's an amazing feat, enormous in scale, and the sheer access to a voting booth or these electronic systems, which is the way that India votes, is incredible. I mean, these electoral offices, they go across the Himalayas, they go to jungles, they make sure even one person in an individual village that is only reachable by foot will get a voting station if they want it. And that is really admirable, and it's something that, you know, India is teaching other countries around around the world about how to make a voting system. And there's access for women. There's almost, actually, by the next election, more women will be voting than men, which is huge as well. Digitally, it's accessible as well. So definitely when it comes to voting, there is no doubt that this is an extremely impressive democratic process, the biggest vote in history. But when it comes to other elements of India's democracy, that's where critics are concerned. I mean, just in the last month or so, we've seen opposition leaders being arrested and jailed. We've seen the Congress Party, which we've spoken about quite a lot, their accounts have been frozen, accused of tax fraud. And what researchers have told us and what they say publicly is that 90% of these cases are targeted at opposition members. The BJP does not seem to be targeted in the same way. And there's concerns around how enforcement authorities are being used in the lead up to the election. And of course, those concerns around freedom of the press. So look, it's really both sides of the coin, but Modi goes out there and he says, we're a democratic country. You can't argue with that. And, you know, maybe there are these criticisms, but they maintain that this is a democracy.
Yeah, we started off talking about the possibility that Modi's government assassinates dissidents overseas. And of course, you yourself have had to leave India. I mean, we've seen in Russia how oppression can escalate into something very, very dark and very, very dangerous, where the same leader holds power for a long time. Is there talk in India that its democracy is in peril?
Of course there is. There are a lot of critics who say that this is no longer a democracy, and they say that up front. Some people say, especially researchers who've looked at this space, they say just because you have free and fair voting, that does not make you a democracy. There are plenty of countries which have voting on paper. I mean, we've seen some of those elections this year alone with Bangladesh, for example, where there was voting. We saw voting in the Pakistan election, and there are concerns around whether that means that there is actually a free and fair vote. And so, yes, while India is different compared to those countries in the fact that its voting on paper seems to be quite open and transparent, there are real concerns about how the Narendra Modi government is acting when it comes to its treatment of minorities, the press, the opposition, any critics or people holding the Modi government to account. And the other concerns and questions I'm hearing are what will happen in the next 5 years when Narendra Modi wins? I mean, it's really unlikely he'll lose this election. I mean, in a big part because there is effectively no proper opposition at the moment that can really challenge him and have that level of popularity. There are people who say he'll still lose seats. But what people are questioning is what will happen in the next 5 years in India? If there is a change of government, what would even happen? Could you change 15 years of this level of shifting of democratic ideals?
Well, there are seven phases in an Indian general election. Two are complete at the time of recording. The third is next week. As you say, Modi and his party are predicted to win. But how is the campaign going? I mean, is there even a vague possibility of Modi losing? Or is at this point, is it just about the scale of his victory?
There's, of course, there's always a chance that Modi could lose. It is still a democracy. That is still a possibility because we've seen in many different countries around the world, the polls say that someone's definitely going to win an election and then it doesn't eventuate. And that is, of course, a possibility here. But I think the difference here is there isn't really a key contender that is able to sort of battle Narendra Modi in this way. We have seen an alliance of more than two dozen opposition parties coming together, trying to put aside their differences and forming this group called the India Alliance. But even that alliance is struggling to agree on policies, who the face of the campaign will be. And obviously, we're already into voting at this stage as well. And I think then that does make you ask a few questions about why Narendra Modi is taking some of these actions. Why is the press being targeted? Why are opposition leaders being targeted? And that's meant some people are saying, well, maybe Modi isn't as secure as he says he is and what the polls say he is. Maybe he is worried. Maybe their internal polling says something different and that he might lose more seats than people have expected and will have to form a coalition. But the fact is, at this stage, from what I've seen on the ground, it does seem unlikely someone else can lead India after this election. It seems clear Narendra Modi will win in some way, but it'll be interesting to see how much of a victory he will be able to get. I mean, he's going around in his campaign saying they'll win 400 seats, which would be a huge, huge victory for them if they could do that. It would be a landslide. But many are saying that that's probably not possible, that the BJP will actually lose seats. So I think that will be the real thing to look at the next election.
Avani Dias, thank you very much. My thanks to Avani Dias. Her 7-part podcast, Looking for Modi, is well worth a listen wherever you get your podcasts. And for more coverage of the Indian elections, subscribe to irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Bernice Harrison. This episode was produced by Declan Conlon. In the news, we'll be back tomorrow.